You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
We appear to be living in extraordinary times. The US financial system is in disarray. In the past month, huge investment banks have been allowed to go bankrupt or be sold for a fraction of their worth a year ago. Homeowners and investors have lost their houses and savings, and many bankers have lost their jobs. To talk about the impact and repercussions of the financial crisis and bailout, we've contacted Greg Albo. Greg Albo is an assistant professor of political economy at York University and a writer for Canadian Dimension magazine. Good morning, Greg.
Hello there.
So can you give me a sense of what led up to the current crisis in the U.S. economy?
Yeah, I think we have to look at that a little bit in longer-term perspective and then immediate features of it. It really depends on thinking of this in terms of a process of class struggle and competition between capitalists that began in the late 1970s. With the crisis then, there developed a profitability crisis, which began a process of how to restore that profitability. And it began an attack on workers' wages, pushing down a range of insecurities into the labor market, the internationalization of production, such as subcontracting around the world, offshoring, and so on. And that began a process of reducing workers' wages relative to the growth in the economy. The other component was competition between capitalism. That's partly meaning that they were offshoring and intensifying competitions between themselves to restore profitability. But it also developed a dynamic in the world market of competitive austerity. That is, every country was attempting to push down its wages, push down fiscal spending, austerity through the government. At the same time, it was increasing competitive capacities through new production techniques and attempting to export outside its own boundaries. This set up a dynamic in the world market that was searching for forms of effective demand that could purchase those goods that were being produced. This then led to a huge bubble of debt, particularly in the U.S., as the key source in the world economy to provide demand. This took all forms in the U.S. The most visible sign of it was, of course, the massive current account deficit that the U.S. began running in the late 1970s and is now a huge percentage of their annual gross product every year. It also was massive development of consumer debt, partly to offset weak wages, also commercial debt, and so on. So there was a mass development of debt in the world market. This was the biggest in the U.S., but also spread elsewhere, as we saw in Japan as well. This then, by the 1990s, was coupled by particular developments in the financial markets from neoliberalism that led to a huge amount of deregulation, undermining the financial firewalls that have been put up as a result of the Great Depression and the financial crash there. And this allowed financial firms to engage in a huge amount of leverage. That is, they were leveraging the amount of good assets on their balance sheets versus a lot of speculative assets and more risky investments. This then leads to the exact problems that began to emerge that's led to this current crisis. One of the ways that firms, particularly financial firms that were attempting to compete and maintain their profitability was in so-called subprime mortgages, that is, mortgage structures that were sold to people with low incomes, unstable jobs, and so on. The people taking these mortgages were people who had their wages pushed down, ranges of insecurity, and were feeling the effects of the government rollbacks from neoliberalism of building housing, public housing. So you had these two things come together. Now, to deal with these very, very risky loans, very, very highly leveraged financial companies, they developed various kinds of complex financial instruments called derivatives markets and credit swap markets and so on. These are highly risky trades between different financial companies, supposedly being a way to share the risk. In fact, they were the reverse. So as soon as we had some measure of slowdown in the economy, people stopped being able to meet their mortgage payments. There started to being a collapse in the real estate markets, collapse in prices, and eventually this started spilling over into these highly leveraged bank balance sheets. And then one bank starts having problems, then in a classic credit crisis, it starts building and compounding to the others. So what began as specific problems of some high speculative real estate firms in California, Florida, with obscure names, started spilling over into the into some of the big banks on Wall Street. The first one being hit was Bear Stearns last year, whose hedge fund that was investing in subprime investment collapsed, and eventually, come this spring, was had to be taken over.
Now, okay, so there was a breakdown in the trust between these banks, and so then they start becoming very vulnerable, each of them, and their assets get are seen as much less valuable than they'd been previously presented as, and so then they start falling one by one. And the
Exactly.
So the U.S. government has then recognized, you know, contrary to its sort of ideological perspective, has recognized that there's a big problem. How have they responded?
Well, one of the things here is just to think of the size of the problem as well. This is partly then you can get an idea of why there's such a credit contagion across the firms. In about 1980, the financial assets as a percentage of world GDP was about just over one-fifth of total GDP. It's now 10 times that. We have a world GDP of $60 trillion. We have $600 trillion in derivatives markets alone. So we have a huge, huge financial speculation out there. This has meant that when we've started when the collapse of some of these balance sheets starts occurring, their assets starts falling, then each firm has got to start selling in turn to try to meet its debt obligations. It starts spilling over. So this is produced a huge amount of losses. The estimates that are put forward are from 2 to 3 trillion. These are put forward by both private estimates and various banking institution estimates. So the federal government in the U.S. is then trying to figure out a way how to stabilize this contagion of collapse in the financial markets. It's been doing a huge numbers of things, and probably has already put in the order of $2 trillion into the financial markets in various ways, or some of its proposals, some of the coming proposals already. It's done that by pumping money directly into the banks, by how it lends. It's been engineering takeovers by banks themselves. So, for example, the buying of Bank America by of Merrill Lynch, and it's been nationalizing some of the companies with the biggest problems. This is the big real estate mortgage companies in the U.S., Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and now it's proposing another $700 billion bailout fund, which is what's being disputed on Congress this week. Essentially a fund to take a lot of these bad assets, what they are calling the Troubled Asset Relief Program, into the public sector and then find a way to slowly sell them off and try to stabilize the balance sheets of the financial institutions on that basis.
Now, we've recently seen on a political front Russia ignoring U.S. bluster over Georgia, you know, the Europeans keeping very quiet on that. And what I'm wondering is this: we're seeing this political shift happening. Is the financial crisis having an impact on the U.S. role globally and politically?
There's a number of dimensions to this. One is, of course, is the U.S. is still the major economic power in the world by far. Its economy is bigger together than the Japanese, the German, the Chinese, and the British economy. So it's still the major economic player. Now, coming out of World War II, the U.S. had somewhere in the order of 45% to 50% of world output. It's now down to about a fifth of world output. So there's been clear modulations over time in the balance of U.S. power to other areas of the world. The period from of neoliberalism from Reagan through to Bush the Younger has actually been a period where the U.S. has kind of strengthened a range of its positions, even as it was losing some relative economic strength. It was doing so through, particularly through its expansion of military capacity, and then especially the way its financial markets were able were enabling both the higher U.S. growth, but also the U.S. to strengthen American imperialism both in the economic and military side around the world. This financial crisis obviously breaks that strategy, and that strategy had underpinned American unilateralism, which allowed the interventions in the Middle East and so on. So we're clearly seeing, in this moment of financial crisis, shifts in geopolitical balances between different parts of the world. One is Russia, both because of Russia's strong foreign exchange position and its energy reserves, and a clear desire among the Russians to reestablish itself as a great power that has to be reckoned with in Eurasia. The other part is, of course, East Asia. And this is very important because East Asia is holding about $3 trillion of American debt and is critical to any recovery in the American case. Clearly, what the Chinese are trying to do is they're trying to form a creditors cartel between China, South Korea, and Japan because they're very worried about how the credit crisis will shake itself out and what it will mean for the assets that they're holding. So they're attempting to bargain strongly in this situation of how to gain access to the American market. This will clearly also have an impact and it will reinforce some of the developments which were already causing the relative rise of China and East Asia compared to American power. But I think this development of the attempted development of a creditors cartel has very important issues in terms of solving the immediate financial crisis, but it also has a range of geopolitical importance, partly because the U.S. has from the World War II on, attempted to keep divided the East Asian countries through its military position, which, of course, was strengthened by the revolutions that occurred in North Korea and in China, allowing the Cold War to be projected through through East Asia. And the U.S. has continued to depend for their space in East Asia and the, putting pressure on these stations to fund the U.S. balance of payments deficit by instability in the region.
What's the likely impact on Canada or the current impact as well?
The immediate impact, of course, is the downturn that is slowly creeping through the Canadian economy. The American slowdown means the commodity prices that were so high in Canada, particularly in the oil and gas sector, lumber, precious metals, and so on, have been declining. Also, the slowdown, of course, of manufacturing exports to the U.S. So the immediate impact of that is recession. Another impact is, of course, that the turmoil in credit markets is spilling over into interest rate structures around the world. So we're seeing much larger interest rate spreads in Canada between what we're, say, getting on our deposits in savings accounts versus what's being charged in mortgage markets or for loans. There also is some impact in terms of the Canadian banking system, which is a bit quite different in one way from the U.S. and quite similar. There will be some additional pressures for consolidation and mergers in the Canadian banking system, although that largely had occurred through the 1990s already, the way that investment houses and investment banks had moved into commercial banking in Canada. But it also means that the Canadian state and Canadian banks are, given their better capital positions than the American banks, are looking to even internationalize even more. And the Canadian state is attempting to find ways also to facilitate the internationalization of Canadian banks. So a number of the big leverage buyout firms in Canada, such as Onex, owned by Jerry Swartz, or and also some of the big banks like the World Bank are also looking at trying to pick up some of the American financial institutions under pressure.
I'm interested in what the implications of all this are for social activism, for Canadian politics in general. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I think one has to really begin, I think, with the grim observation that without a stronger political organization in Canada or in the U.S. on the left, there is no organized radical left. The social movements have faced decline over the last years. It's very difficult to intervene at the level of political forces where these things are being worked out. So the political terrain is almost completely within where the neoliberals are, the right, and they're attempting to reconstruct neoliberalism, which is the strategy from the Bush administration, and to a large extent Obama has endorsed. It's certainly where Stephen Harper is in Canada. And the social democratic movement in Canada has largely not said anything different on these issues except minor comments on regulating the banking industry. So there's not really a lot of left alternatives out there, given our level of political forces. But there are a lot of issues that are quite easily put forward in political debate, and movements that are, of course, growing among the debtors in crisis around housing, et cetera, has a basis for developing into a political movement. There's any numbers of things that can be put forward at this moment. For example, the first thing, of course, would be the range of issues related to the stabilization of the housing market, taking over a range of the housing stock that is in crisis, finding new public and community-based institutions to take it over. And quite clearly, we're dealing with another major failure of neoliberalism in terms of its attempts to use only private housing to deliver housing to low-income and medium-income people. Second thing is quite clearly the case for the public having equity stakes or public ownership of deposit-taking institutions, banks, is clearly being made in this crisis. We're dealing with the largest in dollar value economic failure in history. Quite clearly, markets failed incredibly. And we also see that, in fact, that the public good side of it, needing some measure of an institution that deals with deposit taking, mobilizes savings, is a public good. That's logically exactly when we should have those institutions in the public sector. And we see other examples of that. The Japanese post office system, for example, has been relatively insulated from these problems. Or the French, in the past, French banking system was quite strong. So there's a range of things there. I think a third thing is the struggle what this means for pensions. Again, the financialization pressures and the competition from banks and neoliberal policies led to a lot of privatization of pensions. This was in RRSPs in Canada, 401k plans in the U.S., and the relative rolling back of the public pension system. This is now proving to anybody who has these private pension accounts enormously costly, and we have to go back to restoring guaranteed public pensions, with those public pensions being particularly funded by secure long-term government bond funding, as well as current receipts and current taxation. So I think there's a range of things that are quite easily put forward by the left at this moment in terms of the financial crisis.
Well, thanks very much for taking the time to talk with me about this morning.
Thank you.
I've been talking with Greg Albo. Greg Albo is an assistant professor of political economy at York University and a writer for Canadian Dimension magazine. And you can find material that he's written there at their website.